This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is comic, writer, and actor John Mulaney. He spent 5 years as a writer on Saturday Night Live, starting in 2008. He and Bill Hader co-created the character Stefan. Mulaney returned to Saturday Night Live twice in the past year to host the show. He won an Emmy for writing his 2018 comedy special, Kid Gorgeous, which was recorded live at Radio City Music Hall and is streaming on Netflix. In the animated series, Big Mouth, about adolescence and puberty, Mulaney voices the character Andrew. He's had a long-term comedy partnership with Nick Kroll, one of the creators and stars of Big Mouth. Recently, Mulaney has been doing a series of Sunday comedy performances, sharing the bill with Saturday Night Live cast member Pete Davidson. I can't play you an excerpt of those performances, but we do have a clip from the edition of Weekend Update that Mulaney and Davidson appeared on together in January. The premise was they were reviewing the Clint Eastwood movie, The Mule.
Michael, Colin, hi. So you guys are talking about The Mule?
No, basically never, no. I didn't actually realize that you guys hung out together.
Yeah, we do, but a lot of times it looks like I'm Pete's lawyer.
Yeah. People usually think he's like an NBA coach, and I'm like the controversial rookie.
But for real, I've been spending time with Pete to try to show him that you can have a life in comedy that is not insane. A sober, domestic life.
Yeah, and after observing John's life, I publicly threatened suicide. I'm sorry, I know I shouldn't make that joke.
Pete, but it is funny.
Pete? Look at me. Look me in the eye. You are loved by many.
Oh, thank you, John.
And we are glad you are okay.
Okay.
Now back to the mule.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Okay, it's Pete Davidson and John Mulaney on Weekend Update. John Mulaney, welcome back to Fresh Air. I just have to ask you, what's it like hearing a friend make jokes about suicide when you know it's a real thing for him?
I found that update we did together, one, extremely fun because I got to do it with someone whose comedy I love and who I, you know, love as a friend. And I found it, not to speak for him, but very cathartic. And I do like when things are addressed directly, even if they are a little bald and might be a little shocking. Our intention was to mention it, and I guess my intention was also to try to get Pete to look me in the eye, which is hard on air, and just say how everyone, how myself and many others felt about him and it. Not addressing it would have felt strange, and it was not, well, it's always hard to phrase this, but not a joke about that he did it, more kind of a joke that it happened, but here he is. And I always think when it's the person themselves saying it implicitly to the audience, it's saying, I'm looking at them now and they're doing better. So I thought it was kind of a cool moment.
I loved it. I thought it was both very funny and kind of great to acknowledge, yeah, you're all thinking that it happened, and I'm going to make a joke about it because that's what I do.
Yes, he does. And he is utterly transparent about his life, which I respect very, very much. And especially in the face of it sometimes gathering a lot of press attention. So I admire his guts in talking about that. And it was just then fun to go back to the mule. As worried as I was, or other people were, it was nice to just get back to making fun of a movie we saw.
So, you used to be a writer on Saturday Night Live. So, since we're talking about you and Pete Davidson and a bit you just did on SNL, let's just go there. How did you get to audition for Saturday Night Live?
Well, I was very surprised I got to audition. I had been pretty much a pure stand-up, not a sketch comedy or improv actor, though I had done a little of that. I auditioned August 7th, 2008, and I was informed I would be auditioning on August 5th, 2008. And I think that Seth Meyers and Amy Poehler had seen me a few times at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater doing the monologue portion of the ASCAT show, the long-form improv show they would do on Sunday nights. I got to be the guest that did monologues a couple times. So I, whilst I would have loved to audition, did not see it coming, and had 2 days to get it together, which in retrospect is a perfect amount of time, because had it been any longer, I would have overthought it to a great degree. And then I went in that day, August 7th, and I went in and thought, I am not going to get this. There's no way I'll get in the cast. They had a plethora of Caucasian males with brown hair who were far, far better actors and sketch performers than I. But I thought, this will be a great memory to audition for Lorne Michaels, and I'll just do the stand-up I have that I think would go the best. And it was a really thrilling experience.
Well, what did you do in your audition?
I tried to do jokes that I had that had, like, slight characters in them. You know, not full one-man show immersion in characters. But I had some jokes back then about Law and Order and the different types of people you see on every episode of Law and Order, such as the guy the police interview who's always stacking crates and won't stop even as they're questioning him, who's like, Tony Ramirez? Yeah, I remember him. Good guy, you know, worked on Tuesdays. And the bartender who's shown a photo of the missing person and immediately recognizes her and everything about her. Like, despite being a bartender in Midtown who sees thousands of people every night, like, yeah, blue shirt lady, nice lady, sat at the end of the bar. Why, did something happen to her? It's like, yes, that's why the homicide detectives are speaking to you. So, as you just heard, my voice did not change that much, but I tried to throw in some slight character touches to it.
So were you surprised that you weren't going to be a performer? Was that like a relief or an insult?
It was, I wouldn't say a relief. I absolutely did not think I would be hired as a performer, and had written for a couple sketch shows on Comedy Central and done a little writing work otherwise, so it certainly was something I already liked doing. I was so happy after that audition that I was going to get to be part of that world, you know, even for a little bit longer.
Well, you've hosted Saturday Night Live twice in the past year or so. Did you write your own opening monologues after having written them for so many people?
I did. Yeah, I wrote them, and a large part of them were pieces of stand-up I was doing at the time, both this year and last year. And it was very fun to do after writing so many monologues. I wrote a monologue for, I think, every host for about 3 years, along with the wonderful writer Simon Rich, who my second show approached me at the after party. We really liked each other right away and were already working together. And he said, you and I are going to write a monologue every week because no one wants to write the monologue. So they'll always be an open spot for the monologue. And he said, and guess what? They can't cut the monologue. So that was our sneaky 20, he was 23 and I was 25. And that was our sneaky way of trying to always have a spot in the show. By doing the monologues, didn't realize that you will get to spend time with the host in the most unique way, which is, in some cases, for people who haven't performed in front of a live audience, you're working with them on the thing they are the most terrified about, which
is... Yeah, I never thought of it that way.
Walking out and doing... It's not pure stand-up. It, often cast members join them, or it's a song. But to them, it's like I'm supposed to stand on stage alone on a comedy show and, you know, deliver a very funny speech. And it's a very scary moment for people. And it was a very valuable and interesting and strange experience to be with many people who have excelled in many different fields. And, you know, kind of working with them on the thing that was the most terrifying.
So when you hosted for the first time, were you nervous about it?
I was terrified.
Why?
I was absolutely terrified. I mean, it was everything from, like, the feeling I had when I would have to play basketball in front of my family. it was like, these people know me, and, you know, it's not that people who know you don't love you, but they know you, and so, like, you know, they can't possibly think that I should be here. They've known me since I was, you know, 25 and just standing in the hallway like an idiot drinking Dr. Pepper, and I'm a fraud, which is a common feeling among all people, I think. And the other part of it was that I went in, you know, I'd been there for 5 years and I was a writer and a producer, and I thought I knew everything about the place. You know, I was like a busboy. I was like, I know all the secrets and I know all the ins and outs and I know how to sneak out of the kitchen and I know where we get the meat delivered from. And then they were like, we need you to be the maitre d'. And I was like, great. And then I went, oh my gosh, I have never known what it's like to have to be the maitre d'. You know, as much as I had written and worked behind the scenes, I had not had to step in front of the camera and deal with that. And to be rehearsing things as a performer that I'd written on that show and dealing with camera blocking, all things I'd done countless times on the other side of it, was so jarring. I had no idea how hard this was to be performing something you've written and wanting, you know, trying to listen to the jokes while making sure you're on your mark and looking into the right camera, and then being, you know, pulled around to do costume fittings. And it was an absolute, it was scary. It was a very good education as to what it was like for the other side of it, for all the people that I made, you know, wear wires and fly through the air and put on any costume.
Well, let's hear some of your stand-up on your most recent appearance hosting Saturday Night Live. So this is from last February, and you're talking about being married.
I'm very happily married now. I'm very happily married. My wife is Jewish, and I was raised Catholic, which you could all tell from the moment I walked out. That's not a big deal, getting married if you're Jewish and Catholic. Only a couple people asked about it, and they were my parents. Before we got married, my mother asked me if my wife was going to convert to Catholicism. You're right to laugh. It's a stupid question. Oh, I don't know, Mom. Let me go ask. Let me go see if a 29-year-old Jewish woman who doesn't like any of my suggestions would convert to, what was it again? Roman Catholicism? How would I even have that conversation? What, do you come home with a brochure and you're like, hey, honey, allow me to tell you about an exciting, not new organization. Don't Google us. You know that strange look of, you know that strange look of shame and unhappiness I have in my eyes at all times, especially after sex, and it was all forced on me at birth? What if you voluntarily signed up for it?
That's John Mulaney hosting Saturday Night Live last February. That's hilarious. Was religion an actual issue for you when you got married, or was it kind of irrelevant?
Oh, it was not irrelevant. My mom called me after that show in March, and, you know, we were talking about the show, and she loved it, and she said, I never asked if she was going to convert to Catholicism. And I said, I believe you did. I said, maybe you said, are you going to get married in a Catholic church? I think you directly asked. And she said, I did not directly ask if she was going to convert. And I said, did you want to ask? And she said, oh, yes, I definitely wanted to ask. She said, you have a better memory than me, so I'll trust you. But it was discussed. An issue might imply that something was going to be resolved, but it was discussed, and my mom trusts my memory, so I will reconfirm.
So if I asked you if you had a happy childhood, and I mentioned your childhood because so much of your comedy is about your childhood, and Big Mouth, the animated series that you're in, is also about childhood. So if I asked you if you had a happy childhood, would you be able to even answer that?
Yes, I think I could.
And your answer would be?
Yes, I did. I had a lot of rage that I look back on with amusement. It was normally only momentary, and I was extremely lucky. I had parents that were strict sometimes, had high standards, but were incredibly loving, and I got very lucky. I joke about them a lot, but 0 to 18, they instilled a lot of good stuff in all of us, and also gave us kind of a strange, unique experience that I guess I personally have benefited from, in that I write a lot about that time, and looking back on some of those memories, they are just to me extremely funny, and to others very odd. You know, we were kind of like a family in the 50s, and it was the 1990s, and so just being out of step a little, even if I found it suffocating sometimes back then, it really has paid off in retrospect.
So what was 1950-ish, and what was strange and unique about growing up in your family?
We had dinner together. My dad worked a lot. I mean, he'd be traveling for work a lot, but
he was a lawyer, right?
Yeah, he is a lawyer.
He is a lawyer. Mm-hmm.
And
your mother too.
Yeah, my mother is a law professor now mm-hmm. at Northwestern Law, and so we would have dinner. At all six of us, most any night that we were all together. And, you know, it was sort of like a sit up straight, no elbows on the table dinner. And there were debates at dinner. My dad was a debate champion in high school. And obviously both of my parents went to law school, where that type of open argument is practiced and honed. Yes, we talked political and ethical and moral issues, and were also quizzed on classical music. But yes, it was sometimes intimidating debate at the table. You know, you could be asked about your day. I think I joked about this, where I said that someone was pushed off a seesaw, and my dad questioned me about what I did in the face of seeing this, and I said nothing, and he eventually walked me to the question of, so how are you better than a Nazi? I said, what? And he goes, well, no, how are you better than someone in Germany who saw what the Nazis were doing and did nothing? And I said, I was on the bench. And, you know, my mom would go, Chip, you know, and he'd calm it down a little. But yes, it was the height of debater forensic championships at our dinner table.
So you've described yourself as a song and dance man when you were a kid. And since you love musicals, let's hear an excerpt of a musical you did on Saturday Night Live. And this is also from your second appearance hosting the show. And the musical is called Bodega Bathroom. And you want to describe what it's about?
Yes. It was kind of not a sequel, but a spiritual cousin to a musical piece I did the previous year that I'd written with Colin Jost called Lobster Diner, or Diner Lobster. I'm not sure what the official title is, about ordering lobster in a diner. And we wanted to write another musical piece about a specific New York conundrum, or a New York City taboo, which is asking to use the bathroom in a bodega. Pete Davidson asks to use the bathroom in a bodega, and it opens up a magical world of that bodega bathroom.
It's just a hideous, filthy bathroom in every way you can imagine.
Have you ever gone to the bathroom in, like, a grocery store or a convenience store?
Oh, I really try not to do that.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, everyone tries not to, but, you know, adult life is adult life, and you sometimes have to, and you get led back to this just place, you know, where they're like, they store things, and there's occasionally, like, a family photo that, you know, you're really like, wow, I wonder if that's that guy's parents, and yes, they do try to dissuade you as much as possible, but if you give them that look, there's really nothing you can say, it's just that look in your eye of, you know, sir, I have no options. you either let me behind the soda fridge or something very bad is about to happen. I tried to leave the house. You know I didn't plan this, but there was coffee and my SSRIs have kicked in and a lot of things are going on.
Okay, here's my guest John Mulaney singing the Bodega Man from Bodega Bathroom, the musical.
What kind of creep would let a bathroom get like this?
I did. Who can sell you condoms? An Arizona iced tea? A Lucy cigarettes and plantain chips?
The Bodega Man can. Oh, the Bodega Man can.
The Bodega Man can, cause he mixes lots of pills and calls them tiger sex pills.
Did you ever want to sing, like, for real?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yes. I mean, you can hear both the pathetic mid-range of my voice in that moment, but I believe you can also hear the absolute joy I have in being able to sing in a musical, even if it's for 15 seconds. I really wish I could sing. I cannot. My wife told me I was tone deaf, and I thought I might be tone deaf for a while. And then a friend of mine who was a trained opera singer, I said, I think I'm tone deaf. And she said, okay, sing any melody. And I went, ba-da-ba-ba-ba, which is the McDonald's theme, which was the first melody that came to me. And she said, okay, you're not tone deaf because you can follow a melody. She said, what you are is a terrible singer.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a real, real pleasure.
John Mulaney's latest comedy special, Kid Gorgeous, is streaming on Netflix. The history of television has included several series and movies featuring vampires, but our TV critic David Bianculli says there's never been one even remotely like the new series premiering tonight on the FX network. It's called What We Do in the Shadows, and it's based on a film from New Zealand. Here's David's review.
Over the decades, television has taken some significant new approaches to the ever-evolving vampire legend. The vampires as a persecuted social class in True Blood. The vampire as avenging hero in Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel. Back in the 1960s, there even was the vampire as tragic romantic figure in Dark Shadows, a cult series that managed somehow to build a daily soap opera around vampires, witches, and werewolves. What We Do in the Shadows, premiering this week on FX, takes the Dark Shadows trick and applies it to yet another TV genre, the comedy series. Specifically, the fake documentary comedy series. It's like The Office, only with fangs and occasional spurts of blood. And it's also got a bit of The Odd Couple in its comedy veins, because the show is about a small group of vampire roommates, male and female, sharing the same lair, who really don't get along that well. The original incarnations of What We Do in the Shadows came from New Zealand, where Jemaine Clement and Taika Waititi wrote, directed, and starred in a comedy short in 2005, followed by a very funny feature film in 2014. Both of them have substantial pop culture standing. Waititi directed the recent Thor Ragnarok movie, and Clement is one half of the goofball musical duo Flight of the Conchords. For this new FX version, Clement is creator, and both he and Waititi direct and write several episodes. The new creative edition is co-writer Paul Sims, a writer on The Larry Sanders Show and the creator of News Radio. What they've done for this new weekly TV version is populate the story with entirely new characters. Clement and Watiki no longer star. And they transplant the vampire lair and the action from Wellington, New Zealand to Staten Island, which somehow is just as funny, as are the jokes they choose to resurrect. Like the time when a visiting elder vampire emerges from his coffin to address his followers and notices the camera crew filming the action office style.
I come with a proclamation. The old ways are over.
Which is what I just said.
The new world, as you call it, is our lifeline to an eternal future.
It's a documentary crew. They're cameras.
It's like they're not even here.
They're filming me?
Yes.
Pretend like they're not there. It's kind of a natural piece. You were saying, Baron.
Centuries have passed, and you have not conquered the new world. You hide in the shadows. You are weak.
The parallels to The Office are even more obvious in another scene from the pilot, which starts by having a character speak directly to the camera, then follows him to an actual office as he seeks out his victims. He goes by the very unimposing name of Colin Robinson, and he's a special type of daywalker vampire, which he explains with a deadpan that makes the idea and the accompanying action even funnier. Colin is played by Mark Prouksch, whose credits include The Office.
My name is Colin Robinson, and I am what's known as a psychic vampire or energy vampire. This is my office, also known as the hunting ground.
Hi, Deb.
Energy vampires drain people's energy merely by talking to them.
Actual versus budget year to date? No thanks. You're going to be at that all day.
We either bore you with a long conversation.
I'm feeling better now. I was a little sick this weekend. Hey, Don. Don. I have to pee, too.
Or
hey.
We enrage you. In fact, you probably know an energy vampire. We're the most common kind of vampire.
Other stars in this new series include Matt Berry as the self-styled vampire sex symbol Laszlo, and Kaven Novak as an officious vampire housemate named Nandor, who likes to be known as Nandor the Relentless. And he's so relentless, he even lectures his fellow vampires about keeping the house clean. He's like an undead Felix Unger, and just as annoying to his roommates.
Now, before we go into the reading of the letter, I wanted to talk about general hygiene in the cell. Mm-hmm. Last night, there were all these people down there shouting and screaming, half drunk.
Well, where did they find the alcohol?
No, they were half drunk. They'd been half drunk.
Oh.
Please, finish a whole victim before moving on to a next one, okay? It's very unhygienic.
I'm tempted to end this review of What We Do in the Shadows by sinking to a cheap vampire punchline or pun, and saying this FX series pumps new blood into the genre, or doesn't bite or suck, or something like that. But I've seen the first batch of episodes of this series, and they're all so clever and genuinely amusing, the makers of What We Do in the Shadows deserve better. So I'll just say well done, and coagulations.
David Bianculli is editor of the website TV Worth Watching and author of The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. He reviewed the new FX series, What We Do in the Shadows. Coming up, we talk with Natasha Lyonne, the co-creator, co-writer, and star of the Netflix series Russian Doll, in which her character keeps dying and coming back to life and doesn't understand why. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Natasha Lyonne, co-created, co-wrote, and stars in the Netflix series Russian Doll. When the series begins, she's at a party for her 36th birthday, drinking and smoking cocaine-laced marijuana. A little later in the episode, she leaves the party, and while crossing the street, she's hit by a taxi and killed. But then she finds herself back at the party, alive. And a few minutes later in the episode, she dies again. Here she is describing the situation to a family friend who's a therapist.
Last night I died.
What do you mean?
Last night was my birthday.
Correct.
All right. I went to Maxine's. We got into a fight, so I tried to leave. I fell down the stairs. I broke my neck, and I died.
Okay.
Okay. So then, I'm back at the party. I try to leave, yeah. Fall down the stairs, break my neck. Again, right? So, I died. That's four times. Also, my cat just literally disappeared.
Reviewing Russian Doll in the New York Times, James Poniewozik described it as, quote, acerbic, wittily profound, with a richly satisfying ending. This is a show with a big heart, but a nicotine-stained heart that has been dropped in the gutter and kicked around a few times, unquote. As we'll soon hear, the idea of dying and coming back to life has personal resonance for Leon. She started acting as a child. When she was six, she was a recurring character on Pee-wee's Playhouse. She was the narrator in Woody Allen's Everybody Says I Love You. She co-starred in American Pie and starred in But I'm a Cheerleader and The Slums of Beverly Hills. She was nominated for an Emmy for her portrayal of Nikki Nichols in Orange is the New Black. Natasha Lyonne, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
We've all had experiences that nearly killed us. The car crash that was narrowly avoided, the stairs we almost fell down. I'm sure you experienced those, but you probably also experienced the kind of near death from drugs and being hospitalized. And I'm wondering how that fed the premise of the show.
Yeah, you know, I mean, certainly my very real experiences wildly informed the things that felt topical to me, you know, that felt very tangible, that might otherwise feel esoteric or out of reach, kind of these questions about life and death and what's it all about and, you know, what it means to kind of go on living and what it means to have the sort of instinct to take ourselves out. These questions and riddles, consume me and ultimately also the things I find funniest because they're so dark. It's a curiosity because in the sort of triumph of having a kind of a green light, a writer's room, collaborators, let alone the on-set experience or the sort of picking each song kind of like painstakingly to sort of place to be the sound of the moment. And, you know, certainly now in the aftermath of such kind of positive reinforcement for sort of putting it all out there, it feels like quite the opposite of something, you know, painful or vulnerable or terrifying. I think early days surely were harrowing. And, you know, yet that's sort of, I guess, a concept is, you know, that pain or that fear is a type of a touchstone to ultimate, you know, growth or release and relief.
I think one of the questions that, like, Russian Doll poses is, like, when you come back to life after a death experience, does it make life seem any more or less precious? Does it make you behave any better or worse?
Listen, maybe this is a sideways answer, but the one book that I brought into the writer's room on the first day was Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, you know? And I think that a sort of a childhood and a lifetime of studying the Talmud and sort of these threads that kind of shaped me almost influenced in a way the way I would come to look at things. You know, I remember when I was 16, back when Woody Allen was quite a popular figure, I was doing his film Everyone Says I Love You, and I'd been pulled out of yeshiva in order to do the job. And so I had this wonderful tutor, Karen Cooper, and she sort of explained to me, you know, what surrealism was, and she would make me do these interesting sort of activities like watching Apocalypse Now and the book Heart of Darkness. And so I think it kind of all of those things similarly sort of shaped a very specific outlook to drugs and alcohol, you know, and also idolizing certain figures, you know. I mean, whether that was a Hunter S. Thompson or a Bukowski or a Cassavetes, a Lou Reed. I think all of that kind of went into a melting pot of how I would feel in the face of sort of why drugs and alcohol felt like such a good sort of soundtrack to my experience and how each survival felt. I don't know that I truly had, you know, such a black and white thing as a kind of like a will to live or a, you know, I think a lot of these ideas are kind of very tidy in a way, the way we like to look at things and process them or kind of, we like to sort of simplify. And I don't think that's actually very true to the experience. In a way, also, the simplest aspect of addiction is, you know, addiction. Drugs are very addictive. So that often the kind of like desire to continue them doesn't really account for, you know, an existential riddle, a will to live or the soul. That's sort of been robbed of you once you're in that deep.
I'm wondering if you gave certain of your own characteristics, your personality traits to the character, or perhaps certain characteristics that you've outgrown. For example, like your character is determined not to have connections to other people. She doesn't want to be in a committed relationship until she's in her 60s and preparing for a time when she'll need someone to help take care of her. She sees relationships as impinging on her freedom and pushes people away. Did you go through that kind of phase yourself and give those characteristics to the character?
You know, partially. I think that's definitely a philosophy that I have almost more as a feminist stance of sort of who are you to determine my timeline? You know, like, why is that legal? I mean, a lot of these kind of, you know, figures that I name are sort of intentionally macho. Like, I remember Norman Mailer, Executioner song, you know, like these. My father was a boxing promoter. His big dream was he wanted to be like a Don King figure and bring Mike Tyson to the Tel Aviv Hilton when we lived in Israel. I grew up with a lot of boxing in my life, a lot of these kind of tough guy sort of Pacino and De Niro figures. And the thing I would keep noticing in them is that they weren't limited by time or this need to reproduce that society kind of puts on as the woman's burden. So I think this idea that the one in practical application just means that the one I'm going to die with, so I'm better off waiting until I'm in my late 60s to settle down, is something that comes from kind of that spirit of you don't get to have a sort of one night stand with me and think that I need you for some sort of, you know, reproductive societal purpose of, now I'm a worthy member of the species because look, I've got a partner. I've got my plus one who can get me in the room. From Adam's rib, here I come. You know, it was a sort of all that mentality.
So did you want to be a tough guy when you were growing up?
I don't know that that's really changed, Terry. You know,
did you go about
it a little less self-destructively?
Yes, right.
Now I'm just a tough guy at all you guys, you know, not you, of course, because you're a giant.
Right.
But, you know, I think, yeah, for a long time, I think I thought being a tough guy meant being tough at oneself. Like, how much can I take? And now I think I see it, you know, quite differently.
Yeah, how much can I take is really modeled on a boxing model, right?
A little bit. And I think it's, you know, deeper than that, I think I'm sort of, you know, my lineage is dark survivors. I mean, I come from a real Auschwitz stock. So, you know, Hitler was a big player in my childhood. And it was this kind of, you know, mentality of surviving. And that, you know, even no matter what sort of horrors life throws your way, you know, that was something that had been endured by my grandmother and my grandfather, and you know, therefore it was kind of the litmus test of, you know, a human experience. So when everything is kind of weighed against that, it's becomes a real curiosity.
Did you grow up with stories about how your grandparents survived the Holocaust and how terrified they were of the Nazis? I mean, I grew up with World War II movies, and I had Nazi nightmares. You know, I wasn't told, like, personal stories. of my family. Because my family that died in the Holocaust, like, I didn't know them, and my parents didn't know them. But did you grow up with those kinds of stories?
Oh, yeah. That was a big feature of daily life in my household. And on my father's side, there were kind of these Orthodox black hat Jews who were Garment District, Flatbush. The only famous person I'm related to is Al Jaffe, who used to do the back of Mad magazines, you know, those fold over sections. And there was a lot on that side too of kind of, you know, it's sort of like a survival type narrative, you know, of the Jews as a sort of a put upon people and the need to persevere. And then there was a heavy education around that, you know, of those were the schools I was in as well. So yes, there was Hitler in every nook and cranny of my childhood.
So you were preparing to be the tough guy because your father was the boxer, like enduring in the ring and taking it was part of the ethic you were exposed to, but also the larger ethic of like, you have to survive on your instincts to survive the Holocaust. Most people die, but, you know, maybe you can survive. And, you know, it's a dangerous time. It always will be because you're Jewish. It sounds like a very frightening environment to grow up in, where you're always like bracing yourself for something horrible to happen. Physical blow, or just, you know, people like finding out who you are,
Terry,
and killing you.
The headline is everything's fine now. You know what I mean? People love Russian Doll. So it's the good days are upon us. You know, I certainly think it made me very curious to sort of like see what else was out there and kind of push at the edges of, you know, this thing called reality, and to start kind of like, you know, pushing in a little bit on the time-space continuum and being like, ah, what's this? LSD. Let's see where this takes us. You know, I think it was an interesting sort of setup and foundation for curiosity, because a lot of sort of the big ideas about the human condition were woven into the, you know, very structural fabric of my, you know, formative years.
So when you took LSD, did you have like good trips in which you thought like that it seemed like transcendent experiences, or did you have like nightmarish?
This is probably what they put Dennis Hopper through when after he directed and starred in Out of the Blue. Out of the Blue, what a great movie. Linda Mann's in that movie, Mamma Mia. You know, It's a funny thing to talk about, because from where I'm sitting now, I'm so glad for all of these experiences. You know, they really are the things that, you know, shaped a very specific point of view, a way to kind of, you know, let certain things slide water off a duck's back. Other things, you know, take very seriously. I'd done enough sort of psychedelics that I like to get very Jewish when I say that. I've done enough sort of psychedelics that, what can I tell you? Sometimes we're up and sometimes we're down, Terry. What can you do? You get a good batch of acid, you get a bad batch of shrooms. Who knows where it takes you? That's what my rabbi always used to say.
I'm sure. Mm-hmm. So you studied Talmud pretty seriously, because when you were young, you were in Israel.
Yeah, when I wasn't dropping acid,
when
I
you
was
weren't
studying Talmud.
Well, maybe the two went together nicely for you?
Nobody knows. I'm going to do the rest of it like this.
Well, while we're on the subject of you speaking, I love your voice. Yeah. And like, your voice has really changed over the years. It's gotten like much like deeper and a little rougher. I guess
you should see my organs. You know, I mean, Terry, from you, this is one of the great voices. Now we're just complimenting voices. I mean, I don't know that it bodes well for a long life that my voice is changing, but it also depends what time of day you catch me. I haven't done much speaking yet today. As I warm up, it kind of rises. Sometimes I notice that when I'm really kind of like under pressure, I end up being full Joe Pesci. you know, it sort of depends. I kind of like have to check out the lay of the room and then decide how much I'm going to give.
So your character in Russian Doll says the line, I have the internal organs of a man twice my age.
Yes, like that, for example, is a very me line.
You wrote that? I was wondering if you wrote that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's so interesting that you said of a man twice my age as opposed to the internal organs of a woman twice my age. So tell us about saying of a man.
Yeah. I mean, like those speeches, those are the ones who are really, all that about the one in Practical Application or this, I have the internal organs of a man twice my age. And let's smoke, an Israeli joint laced with cocaine, just like the Israelis do it. These are all sort of my mini zingers, that I bring along for the ride. You've spent much time listing all the things my organs have been through. and so I think we know where that line comes from. I think I often say it because, I'm so cherubic in the face. And so it's funny that people tend to forget that there's nothing but, blacked out organs in here. I associate that with, I don't know, I just, enough with all the he, she, what have you. Come on, it's 2019, I think. And yeah, I like the idea of a character that kind of refers to themselves as a man. Why not? I mean, when I say that line, that's how I say it. So it was a kind of discussion of like, shouldn't it be a woman twice my age? And I was like, I've never said it that way, and I wrote the thing. So these are the things you fight for.
Well, Natasha Lyonne, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Natasha Lyonne co-created and stars in the series Russian Doll, which is streaming on Netflix. She also co-starred in the Netflix series Orange is the New Black. This edition of Fresh Air Weekend was produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Mood Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.